Good evening. We have a new face this evening. Welcome. How did you hear about us? Excellent source. Let's do the introductions around. Angie. I'm just newly back from the mountains again, so I'm trying to adjust. It was a very wonderful women's retreat up close to Yosemite. We did a lot of sitting. There were 30-minute sittings woven into everything else that we did. Somebody taught calligraphy. Somebody brought the beautiful books about this big in which she had copied the Lotus Sutra in beautiful calligraphy. Straight lines all the way across the page. Those were kind of the sugar on top of the more serious parts of discussing practice. And then I guess mine was the cream puff part because we did writing practice, the kind where you let a word appear in your mind or some experience or some feeling and just begin to write and see what shows up. And in the beginning, of course, everybody says, oh, I can't write. I don't know how, and I've never known how. And then they sit down and start to write. Whoa! No, it's I feel like I'm waving a magic wand, because then everybody comes up with something. And usually it's revealing, you know, a story from the past sometimes of something that had deep meaning that people had forgotten about, that had been resting in the unconscious, just waiting to be expressed. It's a very, very moving experience. You must have that too. So, it was a very busy time. 100 yards or so between the Zendo and the room where I did Dokusan, and I was just going back and forth 100 yards all day long and all evening too. But we got to go swimming. Whenever there was a break, there was a beautiful swimming pool. So next time it happens, I hope some of you have a chance to go and taste that too. So we're in the beginning of the record of things heard, Dogen's words to his monks, which we must remember always are for the monks, and adjust our understanding of them to go with our lay practice. Otherwise, we're going to get very confused. Actually, for all that he talks about monk's practice and purity of monkish life and the precepts, he keeps coming back to the sitting over and over again and emphasizing that sitting is the essence and the basis and the really only thing. So the next two, I think three and four are our next ones. They're both very short, so we can read them and see how far we go.
One day he said.
Yes, one day he said.
Well, one day he said, in the community of the meditation master Fo Chao, there was a monk who wanted to eat meat when he was sick. Fo Chao allowed him to eat it. One night the master himself went to the infirmary and looked in. There, in the dim lamplight, the monk was eating meat. while at the same time a demon was sitting on the sick monk's head, eating the very same meat. Though the monk thought it was going into his own mouth, it was the demon, not he himself, that was eating it. Henceforth, whenever a sick monk wanted to eat meat, the master knew he was possessed by a demon, so he allowed it. As I reflect upon this, there should be due consideration as to whether or not to permit something. In the community of Wu Tzu Fa Yen, there was instances of eating meat. Whether permitting or forbidding, the attitudes of the ancients all had to have a particular had particular intent.
Do you understand that? The the importance of not being stuck in the rules. The host at this women's retreat was told by her doctor that she should eat meat. So while we were all having a vegan diet and a very good good meals, wonderful meals, she was around the corner barbecuing lamb. So, well,
and yin and yang, boy.
Exactly, but that's what this is about. That if there's a need for it, that then you feed whatever the demon is that needs it, in order to keep the life of the body going, even though it's. The sickness is a demon, or her out of balance, the nature of her out of balanceness requires her to eat meat. So, if we were Jains, you know, the Jain sect, we wouldn't touch meat no matter what, even if we were going to die. But in Buddhism, it's kind of easy come, easy go. It's taking care of it, each particular situation, and not getting hung up even on the rules and regs, even though they're taken extremely seriously.
Why do you think, and I don't recall ever anywhere else seeing the attribution of something to something evil like a demon, that it's like the more generic explanation in the Buddhist environment is delusion. And this doesn't sound like that. In other words, why didn't Dogen say, oh, this man was sick, and he therefore is given broader ability to let go of the monastic rules because he's sick. Here, they're attributing it to something very evil, and it's almost like a different mindset of thinking. It's a different source of explaining the world, which I've never seen in Zen Buddhist context before, this demon. So why, I mean, your explanation to me appeals a little more, that there's a there's a range of how far you push the rules, and then beyond that you say, no, we have a different situation that requires different rules.
Yes.
That to me is a little softer. This seems very harsh.
It's strange. Mm. It's strange for sure. Mm. It's a strange way of presenting it. But it's certainly unforgettable. I mean, if you're going to try to teach people what the rules are and what the differences are and how you can bend them, this, we'll never forget this.
Right, but in the same way that you were, you know, interpreting it, when I read this, I was thinking, oh, this is only one of the many rules that were put together for monastics. Is every rule that's broken explained by you're possessed by a demon? You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Has that become now the
philosophy
of explaining it? I don't think so either.
No. It's just this one story. We too.
Isn't it the same as Mara, though? Isn't this the same?
Yeah, and Mara is a demon. So, in a sense, you know, it's temptation. rather than something truly evil. Mara is always creating situations of temptation, and certainly eating meat is a situation of temptation. And in this case, the demon gets to eat the meat. The tempted person gets to actually eat the meat because.
No. And my interpretation of that is it's the lily game.
Huh?
I want to hear the because. I mean, what I don't understand is why is he saying, okay, let's feed the demon?
Well, in this case, the demon is an illness, and it requires the meat.
So, demon is some word that we're really not sure what it means in Japanese or whatever, what the word meant. I mean, because if you're saying demon is an illness, that's not exactly a demon as we're thinking of it, like an evil spirit. That's a very different.
No, I think it's more like Mara. I think it's more like a temptation, the temptation to want to have something you're not supposed to have. And in this case, it's wanting something you're not supposed to have, but needing it at the same time. And therefore feeding it, of being allowed to feed that.
So it's different. Mm-hmm. Wanting and needing are not the same.
But this is about need.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the precepts are about wanting. Mm. So that's the difference. In this case, because it's a need, you feed the demon.
I have a difference. I just wanted to mention that it's very different from our American life. And an example is the situation I'm going through now. I'm trying to get one day off so I can sit the whole week without.
Oh, Sharon, you're still trying to do it?
I'm still working. No, but the point is, one of their reasons for saying no is because if they allow me, I mean, how this relates to what we're talking about, yeah. If they give me that exception, well, what about all these other people who've asked for exceptions? Rather than, let's say, looking at each one and evaluating.
Yes.
I mean, they might still evaluate it as no, I have one more chance. But, you know, but in a different. For different
ways,
looking at each individual.
Yes. And what Dogen is saying is that whether permitting or forbidding, they all have had the particular intent of each situation is what we address. Because otherwise it's just too vague and too unfair. Well, let's all cross our fingers. Julie?
I have a question. Could you say that the rule itself, do not eat meat, created is a pretty strong word, but suggests a demon, maybe? Like, I mean, though the rule obviously is there for a reason, that this blanket statement, this guy needs meat, would this demon even have been there if there wasn't that rule in the first place about we shouldn't be eating meat?
The illness would have been there?
Well, I mean, this notion of this demon.
Yeah, but the demon is not... It's not an evil creature. It's the man's wanting and needing to eat meat, which is forbidden for monks, for compassionate reasons. It's not just a rule for nothing. It's a rule because it's considered to be compassionate not to eat animals. So monks are strictly forbidden from eating meat. Although, back in Buddha's time, they did eat meat if it was offered. The instruction was to eat whatever was offered, but don't ever have an animal killed for the sake of your eating it. So you'd never pay somebody to kill a chicken and roast it for you. But if somebody at a dinner party offered you chicken, you would thank them very much and take a little bit. It's just the way of being in the world and being flexible and particular again and open. So eating meat isn't, you know, the only demon-like quality of it is that it's a temptation to want to eat, have something that you have already vowed you're not going to take. You know, the monks take a vow. All of those precepts are vows. And they promise, cross their heart and hope to die, literally, that they won't do it. So then there's this little tickle in the back of your head thinking, boy, I sure would love a steak. No. And so that's the demon.
It's weird because as, like, I consider myself a vegetarian. And at some point, I don't think vegetarians even want meat. It doesn't even become a question of temptation.
You know, sometimes it does when you're not well.
Well, Dalai Lama's. Meat, that's like for the
that's
five, right.
Right? That's
then
right.
This demon is still. Why is it?
So the demon is there because the man is sick. It's his sickness. The Dalai Lama's doctor told him he should eat meat because he was weak. When you get old, you often are told by your doctor to eat meat because it makes you stronger.
Protein.
But animal protein.
Yeah.
I mean, there are lots of other kinds, but animal protein especially. It's a very good lesson for us about not being too strict. You know, we need to be strict with ourselves about keeping clear and aiming toward staying clean in some way. But we have to make sure to be in the moment that we're actually in and dealing with the situation that we're actually dealing with rather than pasting on high ideals that don't perhaps fit. So it's about doing no harm.
I guess I just question whether I don't know, just associating the demon with the sickness.
Yeah, well, that's Dogen's.
It's
Dogen's words. He's a poet, and he kind of it is. It's very weird. It's a very strange, weird way of talking about it. But as I say, it's also unforgettable. You know, it's if you're going to make a little lesson. This is a very weird and unforgettable little lesson about how to be. We dwell in preconceptions. We dwell in prejudging situations so often without even noticing it. So much of practice is about waking up to the particular, actually attending to what's happening now, not what we think it is or we'd like it to be. Shall we go on?
One day he said, know that if a person is born in a particular house and enters a particular path, he must above all cultivate the work appropriate to that house. If it is not your own path and you know it is not proper to your own station, it is wrong to cultivate it.
Now, as men who have left home, when you enter the family of Buddha and become monks, you must practice the appropriate activity. To practice the appropriate activity and maintain the appropriate bearing means to abandon selfish clinging and follow the instructions of the teacher. The essential meaning of this is to have no greed or desire.
If you would be free of greed, first you must leave selfhood behind. In order to leave selfhood behind, the contemplation of impermanence is the foremost mental discipline.
Most worldly people want to be always well spoken of and well thought of by others. However, they're not always well spoken of nor well thought of. If step by step you abandon selfish clinging and follow the words of your teacher, you will progress. If you claim to acknowledge this truth, yet say, that may be so, but I can't abandon such and such a thing. If you cling to it fondly and practice it, you will sink lower and lower. The foremost mental discipline for a monk in order to improve is that he should concentrate only on sitting. It is not a question of cleverness or dullness, of sagacity or stupidity. If you sit in meditation, you will naturally become calm.
I think, always think that's the best message of all that we receive. Not a question of cleverness or dullness, of sagacity or stupidity. Doesn't matter whether we're rich or poor, big or small. It's very strange, really. But it's defining essential human being. These teachings, when they came to Japan, were radical because Buddhism had become extremely hierarchical, and you had to be rich and smart and have a lot of influence in order to even become a monk in the various great temples of Kyoto and Tokyo and Edo. It wasn't a matter of intention or even piety. It was a matter of who you were. In Buddha's time, it was the same. Anyone could join, including untouchables. Radical. Radical in the face of how human beings generally assemble themselves and work things out. Usually it's a pecking order. And usually they're the alphas who are dominating and controlling everything and making the rules. And then everybody else. And then all the ways that there are of slowly clawing your way to the top, if you can do that. I heard a Zen Center teacher a few weeks ago talking about how he clawed his way to the top of the Zen Center hierarchy. And I thought, oh, you know, it's still happening in Soto Zen. It's totally natural. And these teachings are slightly, you can't say they're unnatural, but they're a slight step down deeper into the matrix of the reality of how we are and how we really want to be. Our effort is always to find that place from which we come and to which we long for return. And it's always counter to the way that things are built up and structured in the world. So that the great teachers come and it's not that they break down the structures, they just offer a safe place for people to find what they are in spite of or as well as the structure, as well as the superficial life of how everything is run. Jesus had the same teaching. He met with everybody, not just the right people. So when he says to practice the appropriate activity and maintain the appropriate bearing means to abandon selfish clinging and follow the instructions of the teacher, it's his instructions to men who have left home and entering the family of Buddha, practicing the appropriate activity. So it seems like we all can ask ourselves, what is appropriate activity for our lay life? If we were to write instructions to each other, what would we say about how to do? What would it mean for us to leave selfhood behind? And create a contemplation of impermanence. Is it the same? And
so the answer is yes, there are appropriate activities to that house. And the way Dogen and his monks lived is clearly in a different time. They had their technologies that were more advanced than what existed back, prior to them. But today it's very evident that we live in a different time. And there are things that are appropriate to our way, our condition. And yet, what I think is wonderful about the practice is there are also some incredibly common things that have never gone away. We're still human. And I'm sure that what, the Tang Dynasty guys, people in China and the people in Japan and the people now are experiencing are identical because we're human. So there's something running in common, but the house, the environment in which we execute that, is different. So what is it they say? The wind is the same, but the location is different.
Is it still Buddha's house?
Sure. I think that there are people who can practice hardcore, rough and tumble management of a high tech company with compassion, with thoughtfulness, with awareness. Sure. Let's practice that.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
I agree. It's our challenge. It's our challenge. People often ask, what is the difference between monk and lay person, or monk and priest and lay person? And I try to think about it and try to answer, and I never can very well. I don't ever quite understand the difference. Although, there are outward differences, but once we've stepped into this family of Buddha, this Buddha life, then those distinctions are so superficial in my mind that I just have a hard time making those distinctions. Seems like everybody is a monk or everybody is a Buddha. So why do we have to accept that we need somebody to marry us and bury us, and I'm not even sure we need monks anymore. The ones who maintain the practice in a closed away place. Though in Soto Zen, in Zen itself, you're not meant to go in the monastery for your whole life. You just go for a few years of training, and then you go out, as I've said before, and become a high school teacher or a pharmacist or an airline pilot or something interesting, and bring the practice into the world with everybody. So you're a monk for a few years, and then you go back every year and sort of do a short practice period with your old buddies and sort of renew your vow together in the context of Zazen. It's really the sitting practice itself. It doesn't matter who we are. In fact, it's best to be able to be a kind of chameleon and be who you need to be in each situation. Sometimes it's very helpful to be a monk. I have a friend who became a Buddhist because she saw Koban's robe as he walked by. She caught a glimpse of his robe, and it just changed her whole life. She saw something. Who knows? But sometimes, you know, if you're in a world of, I don't know, Tupperware, then you become a kind of Tupperware person with everyone and find a way of being particularly in that situation as compassionately and as wisely as you are. So there's nobody special to be. Now, each one is completely individual, of course. So each one of us brings whatever we are into each situation. We often surprise ourselves. Is there anything else about this one? Jane?
I'm surprised by how emphatic Dogen was about being, knowing what house you're from and behaving appropriate to that house. My response was, you should be so lucky, maybe. Maybe that's the wrong word, but do we know anymore? Have we ever known what house exactly? Where does it come from? Is that an exhortation to discover that?
Well, what he's suggesting is that the monks have actually already agreed to be in the house of Buddha.
Oh, so he means it literally.
He means it literally.
Okay.
And I think our question is, how can we live the life of Buddha in the house of Buddha as lay practicers, who also maintain a life that's not sheltered? I think it's our challenge. But it's also a gift. It's what we can bring to where we are. You know, our practice. Being aware of our house is about taking the refuges, I think. Now, that's sometimes called returning home to Buddha, home to Dharma, home to Sangha. And that we can do anywhere, need to do anywhere.
Thank you. feel that's what affords the courage and tenacity to not know.
Yes.
So you're kind of holding that refuge in one hand, but in the other hand, you don't have a clue.
Moment by moment, we don't know where we're going, but we have our intention, our deep intention. So, of course, we are carried by our intention as well as our willingness not to know. They go together. It's what makes life such an adventure. Sharon?
I guess when I think of the house, in a way it's almost one way that if I think of as the difference between a lay person and a monk, in that lots of the same kinds of issues happen, but when you're in a place where you're surrounded by monks, you're just being in the house of Buddha best you can. But when we walk outside, we may wish to take this house of Buddha with us, but we're also in another house.
Yes.
And we need to be appropriate to this other house as well as this house. And I think that's also a big challenge.
Yes. Yes.
I'm aware of it because I finally realized that I'm from a different house. I always thought people didn't understand me, and I have finally come to realize that I don't understand other people. That's what's been my problem in terms of the general American way of being. So I was sometimes not act as some people felt was appropriate to their house. So we have a whole multi-layer of houses that we're working on, and then we still, if we wanted to be Buddhist in our practice, we have that. It's a lot of houses. that doesn't sound right, but
It's many rooms in a house. You might think of it that way. It's really just one house.
Well, maybe each person is one house.
Yeah.
We can think of houses in different.
Julian?
Well, I mean, these kinds of conflicts happen, first of all, in monasteries. Like the
sure.
Human, that's one thing. And
sure.
Another thought that I was having was like the concept of Buddhist house. I mean, I think like the Buddha way, I mean, I think that's the only thing that, sounding fanatical, but like it seems to be like the only thing that really works, and that I feel a sense of truth in that. Like there's a dynamic that, like the way the world is not static, it's in constant. And we as humans have a hard time sometimes discerning that, but it's a lot more dynamic than we're willing to recognize.
Yeah.
Like I saw this movie about Antarctica.
Yeah.
And as much as the way our brains work, we see it as this like block of ice in the bottom of the world. It's actually extremely dynamic, constantly changing and responding to everything that's around it.
Yes. Yeah.
And to me, that's like Buddha's house right there.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the practice is kind of staying close to that as possible, is it?
Yes, yes, to that knowledge of impermanence, really, and the dynamic that is constantly there's no word for it. I don't know how to say that. There's one more thing he says here that we haven't mentioned, though, that to be free of greed, we must leave selfhood behind. So, and we do that by contemplating impermanence. So selfhood is always the sticking point. That's what keeps us from forgetting that we're in Buddha's house in the first place. At the retreat, at every meal before we ate, we were made suggested that we stand up and with our hands in gassho chant, "May all beings be free from self-clinging." And at first I thought that was sort of silly, and then as the days went by I thought, that's really pretty good. That's really what it's about. May all beings be free from self-clinging, starting with this one. And that's an over and over process. And that's as we look at how things are and how they shift and change and where we stand, which shifts and changes, we have to see there's nothing permanent here.